As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us now in our Bloomberg 1130 studios is William Lee. Bill is the chief economist at the Milken Institute. It's great to have you with us here.
Great to be here, David.
Let me start with these two Italian banks. I will not torture the audience by trying to pronounce them, but I want to talk to you about regulation here in the U.S. But let's start broader. Let's start with the message this sends, this Italian bailout sends, about how the regulatory landscape looks in Europe.
You know, the regulators are trying to fix the European banking system by saying, you know, we got to get bail-in. We got to get the stakeholders to really care about the banks. And so they want the management to say, we got to do better banking. We got to give better loans. And the stakeholders have got to make sure the management does that. What this signal says is that, you know, next time. Now, right now, we're going to do the old good bank, bad bank model. We give the good assets to Intesa, and for the bad banks, you know, bad assets, we're going to have the taxpayer take care of it. That just raises moral hazard. And as a model for the rest of the European Union and the banking system there, it's a terrible precedent. And I think one of the things that the regulators have to get their act together about is, do you really seriously mean the policies that you're putting in place? And if you do so, stay with them. Make sure that you have some credibility being formed. Right now, the Italians have really gone backwards. Or actually, you know what? It's probably good for the Italians, but it's lousy for the rest of the euro area. And the regulators in the rest of Europe are going to say, my God, what are these knuckleheads doing?
We had a spirited discussion last week. Bob Shiller was to my right. Across from him was Peter Wallinson of the American Enterprise Institute. We were talking about Dodd-Frank and how financial regulation looks today, lo, these many years after the financial crisis. And something that Professor Shiller said that struck me as interesting is it's hard to assess the efficacy of this law because it hasn't really been tested in many ways yet. You don't know how it's going to work when we have another crisis or we have the need for, when banks are in another precarious position as they have been. Where do you see the status of Dodd-Frank? Can you begin to assess its efficacy,
I'm glad you bring that up because Milken is all about getting capital to the right places and to the right people. And the banking system is absolutely critical for getting it to small businesses. And so in fact, what we're doing in Washington is to hold a roundtable to try to assess where the Dodd-Frank legislation is going. Insofar as it's been implemented, no one really knows how well it's doing because the implementation is a fly-by-night kind of story. That is, we're going to figure it out as we go along. We kind of have a figure out for the U.S. banks now. We've raised capital. That's great because the U.S. banks are stronger than any of the European counterparts. So we're super competitive on that score. But now they're going to say, you know, it's been such a successful model, so-called, because we now have strong big banks. Let's apply it to the rest of the financial system. And that's where the problem is going to be. Because you can define a systemic failure as a bank going down because it's part of the payment system. And the payment system is what makes the bank systemic. Now, what happens when you have an asset management company? And suddenly the asset management company says, oh, gee, we have a lot of losses here because some weird event happened, whether it's international or domestic or whether it's a company or sector. Now you're going to ask yourself, what is systemic about a company like BlackRock, right? Is that the fact that people lose a lot of money, does that make it systemic? Well, yeah, it's lousy if you're a Chicago pension fund, right? But if you're just a rich hedge fund owner, right? Hey, yeah. You're supposed to lose money.
Good morning. Bill Lee with us with the Milken Institute. To me, one of the great topics is leverage is solution. And that if you have less leverage, everything is supposed to get better. Do you buy that idea?
No.
Is that too simplistic?
I think that is the greatest nonsense in the world. Because
thank you.
Leverage is not a source of risk. It's an amplifier of risk. If you have a lot of leverage, yes, whatever goes wrong goes badly, really, really badly. But whatever goes right goes really well. And so leverage is something that's a tool that you're supposed to use along with all the other tools.
And I don't want you to comment on the Swiss banks, but the Swiss banks lead the charge with bringing down the leverage, making for a more solid balance sheet. Do you suggest that really doesn't change the risks out there?
What changed the risk is to change the risky behavior of management. So what the Swiss are trying to do is to say, we're going to take away the amplification that we know bad management is going to do. So what that's implicitly saying is that we don't trust the management. We're going to take away all of the transmission channels that amplify the risky stuff that they're doing. And I think that's the wrong way about it. Go to the source. Go to the source of what they're doing that's causing the systemic risk to be such a big concern, especially for a national authority like the Swiss.
We got this 140-150-page report from the Treasury Department last week, the first chapter of many, I gather, from the Treasury Department. That was focused on banks, regulation, and banks. What did you learn from that document about where this administration is headed when it comes to regulation? Laid out in that report are steps that the regulators can take to change rules. What did you take away from that report?
I think that it shows that the administration actually was listening to what people were saying about the implementation of Dodd-Frank. As I said, it's sort of fly by night and sort of doing it by ear. But what the administration is saying is that we've heard some good ideas, and so what we're going to do is not mess with the legislation, because that's going to be a mess to have to go through Congress, but we're going to deal with it on a supervisory level. We're going to have the supervisors implement it in the same way that takes into account the feedback from the people.
When you were with Willem Boudert at Citigroup, you were flying at 30,000 feet. Now you're with Milken, so you're up at 70,000 feet with oxygen strapped on. If a mere mortals like us look at the economy, is it a 3% U.S. economy right now?
What's unfortunate is that the productivity numbers just haven't come up. And by definition, you can't get the high growth numbers we want, which is 3% or better, without productivity coming up. And why is that? Because you haven't used technology properly. Why haven't you used technology? Because the people who have the technological progress that can apply the stuff haven't been getting the funding. And getting back to the regulators, if small banks are not putting out small loans, and instead what Dodd-Frank has done is to, and I've written about this, that it's in the American Banker, it's on our website, what Dodd-Frank has done is to incentivize banks to get big loans out, because it's less, more cost effective for them to give big loans. And that just feeds money to the companies that don't need it, the medium to large size companies that have money coming out of their eyeballs. The small companies that would get you the high growth rates, the high technology components that are going to be integrated, as the BMW case is a good example that we mentioned earlier, that BMW was able to combine good management, good technology, and increase American jobs in building cars, of all things, right, to export for BMW. That's the kind of technology we need to incentivize, and that means getting loans out to small businesses with the good ideas that'll hire more people.
Does this administration get that? Does the president get that? We saw what he said when he was in Europe on his first trip abroad about the German trade deficit. Does he understand the role that a company like BMW is playing in creating American jobs?
Well, don't forget, BMW producing cars here is increasing the American surplus by exporting cars out of here. And I think that's the future of new trade policy. The future of trade policy is not going to be between countries. It's going to be between within the sector and between companies. We're going to try to find ways of trying to shape the already distorted trade that's out there, because nobody in their right mind believes this free trade. It's a world of distortions, because what's the EU all about? It's called a customs union, right? That means we've distorted trade to favor the European countries. What we need is another offsetting set of distortions to put American workers back into the groove again, and to get technology into the hands of increasing productivity.
This is a real treat. William Lee is known to write dense, must-read reports. For years, he did this at IMF, at Citigroup, now at the Milken Institute. But then you'd love to come out with these brilliant, original Bill Lee charts. The JOLTS survey, the amount of people being hired as compared to the amount of job openings. To summarize for radio, I just put the chart out on Twitter. We have almost halved from the peak, and we're down 26% on a quick cycle basis analysis. I did. There's a numerator and there's a denominator. Is it about a lack of hirings? Is it about too many job openings? Which way does this cut?
it's about hiring, not keeping pace with job openings. And what does that really mean? What, when do you start looking for labor? Because you want to upgrade your labor force. You want more productive people, and you want people who are just better trained. So you're looking for a lot of people. And right now, at 4.3 level of unemployment, you're saying, gee, I have a tough time finding the kind of people I want. But at the same time, what's the secret sauce behind hiring? You got to raise wages, right? You got to hire up.
Why won't wages go up?
Because
this chart is ugly. It's log quadratic. There's an accelerative force here
because
to the lack of hiring.
Because companies don't need the labor. Because at
2%, wait a minute, you just told me they have.
They want to upgrade. Hey, I'm lost. Tom,
this is like the conversation I had this weekend.
Tom, I want to be rich and thin, but you know, I'm still poor and fat. You know, and I've been poor and fat for 40 years. Just because I want
something. Why is he looking at me?
Just because I want something doesn't mean I get it, right? And so companies want to have better labor, but they're not willing to pay up for it because they know the labor isn't being productive enough because the revenues aren't there to pay them. And so they said, look, I'm not willing to pay up, but I'm really looking aggressively to get better worker. So I'm going to take my time. I'm going to use part-time, overtime, anytime I can get, but not full-time, because with full-time, I got to worry about healthcare costs, this whole Obamacare transition. Why put up with that? So until I find the perfect guy, I'm going to be aggressively looking, but I'm not hiring. And more importantly, I'm not putting up wages. And that's where you don't get inflation, because all the transitory inflation we're getting is from the exchange rate, from oil prices, but not sustained wage growth.
I would just cut in here, David, and say the key phrase there from Professor Lee was the idea of no revenue. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody's looking for.
Bill, if you had a couple of minutes with the Fed chair, what would you say? I look at your notes, and it seems like a huge takeaway here is you are not one who thinks that we should be focusing on the balance sheet at this point. Why is that the case? Why is your
because
call that we should
say,
be looking
I should
at right
say,
now?
Chair Yellen, what's driving your balance sheet policy? What, in theory, bothers you about the balance
sheet? It's a big number.
It's a big number. And that's all you're going to tell me is that it's $4 trillion, Bill. Where the hell have you been?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, $4 trillion relative to the GDP. Next year, it's going to be smaller. Next year after that, it's going to be smaller. So if you leave it alone as a share of GDP, it automatically starts to go down. The thing that you should be telling everybody out there is, what's driving my monetary policy normalization? You're telling me the real rate and expected inflation is going to get me a nominal interest rate of like 3% plus? Great. I know the principle behind that. What's the balance sheet principle? John Taylor's telling you, look at reserve use by banks. And yes, reserve use has gone up, but it has nothing to do with your operating system now, because you now have a quarter system that's divorced the size of the balance sheet from your operating system. So you don't need to worry about the size of the balance sheet just to be able to maintain the Fed funds rate where it is. So ultimately, Janet Yellen, why are you using the balance sheet as a policy tool? And then maybe you might come back to me and say, Bill, I'm worried about the term premium. And I said, is that the job monetary policy, to get the term premium from a negative number to a positive number? No, that's what the market's supposed to do. So there again, go back to leaving the balance sheet alone. Raise rates because there are market distortions associated with it, and don't tell everybody the lie that you're worried about inflation, because you know you're not.
Is this a thing where once the Fed begins to unwind this balance sheet, it's going to continue on, depending on who perhaps replaces Chair Yellen, who else fills these seats on the Federal Reserve Board? Is this something that's subject to change here in these next few months?
I think they're so committed to it, they can't go backwards. So it's gone
institutionally.
Institutionally, in order for them to maintain the credibility, yes, they're going to be reduced in size of the balance sheet. But they told you how they're going to do it. We're going to do it so slowly, you're going to be bored out of your brains. You're going to be watching grass grow, right? Or paint dry, or whatever metaphor you want to use. That's how they're going to do it. And if it's that unimportant to you, why mess with it to begin with? But now you're stuck. You have to mess with it. Do it slowly.
But if they don't get wage growth because your hires to opening chart, I mean, how can you raise rates into tepid real wage growth environment?
Because raising rates is not going to do anything to the economy right now, because no CEO out there is going to tell you, I'm not expanding capacity because of the cost of capital. Cost of capital doesn't matter. What matters to me is I don't get revenues, I don't get demand. And you know, if you actually raise rates, you might actually get consumers to spend more, and that's probably the next time I come back here and I'll explain how that works to you.
There you go.
Very good. Bill Lee with us with the Milken Institute. Thank you so much. I put that chart out on Twitter. It's an absolutely remarkable chart, what's occurred. And a major shout out to one Michael McKee. Do you know him, David?
Yeah, I do.
He's an occasional guest. Michael McKee, way out front with the importance of the JOLTS survey.
Yes.
He used to lecture me. Tommy, you got to pay attention to the JOLTS survey. Uh, Joining us right now on banking, it's been way, way too long since we caught up with him. Certainly the dean of the view of all of the banking, too big to fail, regional banks, small banks as well. Gerard Cassidy, RBC Capital Markets.
We'll Gerard, ask him about ticks, I suppose, or lobsters, right?
Well, yeah, we usually do a lobster report. We'll get to that in a moment. Gerard Cassidy, where's the value in banking right now? Big banks, regionals, or the lesser banks? Which is it?
Tom, I think the real value is the largest banks, and the reason being is that they should get a very good scorecard this week on CCAR, which is the stress test that they do every year. But more importantly, as you might recall, a couple of weeks ago, the Treasury issued a paper on the modifications that they're thinking for Dodd-Frank, and those modifications that Dodd-Frank will be the big banks will be the biggest beneficiaries.
Are we getting better at doing these stress tests? I wonder what we learned from the Treasury Department about this administration's interest in continuing them, and if 5, 6, 7 years after this law was passed, it's become a more reliable way of assessing the integrity of a bank.
It certainly has done a very good job in measuring the integrity of the banks. It may have actually gone a little too far. Even Governor Tarullo, he's the former Federal Reserve Board of Governor who was responsible for creating these tests, and even he pointed out that maybe they've gone too far in terms of being too strict. So I think what the Treasury is going to do is ease back a bit to be able to stimulate lending more because these tests have gone a little bit too far.
Gerard, the criticism has been that they're too quantitative. What does that mean exactly? And if not quantitative, what should a stress test be?
Well, it's interesting because the quantitative part of the test assumes a draconian economic outlook, and they take a look at the bank's loan portfolio to see how it's impacted. And of course, you're going to generate hundreds of millions of dollars of losses, and you need the capital to be able to sustain that. And the industry does that extremely well now. On the qualitative front, which is what we're seeing this week, that's where it's a subjective analysis by the Fed on internal systems and corporate governance. And there's a debate whether the qualitative part of the test should continue, and we expect that to end. It has already been canceled for the banks under $250 billion in assets.
Gerard, what's the mindset of management on deploying cash to shareholders? One of the great themes we've heard from you, from Charles Peabody, there's been a revolutionary shift, if you will, in the thinking of what to do with cash at banks. Do you buy it? Is that sustained now and embedded in the process?
Tom, I think it is, especially with a few of the bigger banks. Citigroup in particular is very focused on returning that excess cash or excess capital. Our biggest banks, as you guys probably know, are not permitted to buy depositories because their market shares are so large and it's against the law. So they have to give it back. So managements are more focused on that. And I think M&T Bank Corp up in Buffalo, New York is probably one of the best at doing it.
I know you've been looking at, you had a great note out looking at what effect the balance sheet unwind at the Fed might have on these banks. Give us the broad takeaway from the research you've done on that. In other words, we got a rough outline from Chair Yellen a couple weeks back about how the Fed's going to proceed doing this. What does that mean for the medium-sized large banks?
It's probably going to be the next big issue for the industry. Many of us recall what happens to banks in a credit cycle, but we don't see a cycle coming anytime soon. However, the liability side of the balance sheet, the industry's deposits have skyrocketed. This is primarily due to quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. Now that the Fed's going to start to peel back their balance sheet, inevitably the deposits are going to come down. We think in checkable accounts alone, there's $1.2 trillion of excess deposits in the system today.
And now, folks, we go to where we always go with Gerard Cassidy. That little bank you need to know about. This is fun. Jerry, you know, I give you grief about this, but it's fun. Where's the value in a little bank right now? Give us a stock.
Tom, I think one of the names investors should look at is Prosperity Bank Shares, ticker FB, PB, I mean, Peter Bill. Prosperity is down in Texas, run by Chairman and CEO Zolman. He does a phenomenal job. Texas, as you know, is a growth area for this part of the country, it's part of the U.S. I would also point out his loan-to-deposit ratio is very low, and it ties into our comments about how the tightening by the Fed, the unwind on the Fed, is going to affect balance sheets. He's perfectly positioned for that.
It's done a double. Come on. In the last 18 months, this puppy's gone 35 to 75. It's rolled over a little bit. I get it. How can it extend out further gains?
Oh, I think what we'll see is, as the consolidation of the industry continues going forward, his stock will certainly benefit from some of his peers. Not saying that he'll sell out, but he has run such a strong bank for so long, and as the M&A activity picks up for the industry, he certainly will get some benefit from that. But also, he's demonstrated he knows how to run a bank very, very well.
Jared Cassidy, thank you so much. Peanut butter, PB, Prosperity Bank shares, Houston, Texas, 3,033 employees. Good morning, David Zalman, Tim Tamanis, the vice chairman, and Edward Safadi. I hope I'm pronouncing that. Safadi, I guess I should say. And Houston, Texas, Jared Cassidy, thank you so much as always. Great briefing.
You're welcome.
I love doing this, David Gura, with Jared Cassidy. He's been doing this, you know, since lobsters first came to Maine.
We didn't get our check on lobsters. We'll get another check on lobsters. I had a few last week in there.
Yeah. but it's really important, folks, that when we spend, you know, to be kind, 90% of our time on six banks.
Yes.
I mean, it seems that way, maybe seven banks. And there's a whole other banking world out there. And guys like Jared Cassidy, they try to find value. They can be wrong, but there he is, Jared Cassidy. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Bob Cinch is with Amherst Pierpont with a storied career on Wall Street. Bob, I got the DXY chart up here, sort of a quick cursory look at dollars, old trading partners and all. For the first half of the year, the dollar's down 5.8%. Are you surprised?
Well, a little bit about the magnitude of the adjustment. You know, we did feel at the end of last year the market's gotten a little bit too bulled up on the dollar, and as we often see at the beginning of the year, have great expectations for the Fed and what they'll do during the year. And then, of course, we get a weak first quarter. We've gotten a little bit of a setback on inflation, and so there is now increasing uncertainty about how much the Fed will follow through. But I think on the other side, we've now taken a market from being excessively positive on the dollar to probably being excessively negative on the dollar and positive on a number of other currencies. So I think we're in a bottoming process. And in fact, the dollar will probably have a pretty good second half of the year and maybe end up the end of this year where it ended up the end of last year.
What's the source of the greatest uncertainty about Fed follow through at this point?
You know, I think that it's really been the inflation numbers. We've had a big surprise, part of it related to suddenly putting in cheaper prices for cell phone usage and everything else, and that's had a big impact on the reported inflation numbers. But I do think that it's interesting, you know, a year ago it was rising inflation sort of dragging the Fed into higher rates. What's interesting now is the inflation numbers have rolled over a little bit, and this recent drop in oil prices will probably contribute to that a little bit in the months ahead. But it's the Fed that's actually kind of now resisting the decline in inflation and talking more about normalization, and that's an issue that I've thought was a big dichotomy for a number of years, and that is the Fed would like to have, I think, the real Fed funds rate adjusted for inflation back to at least zero. And so it's just been difficult for them to get there. I think they now look at the labor market, they look at overall financial conditions, and they say, you know what, this is our environment to get the real Fed funds rate back to zero. Now, the question will be, does a real Fed funds rate at zero imply a nominal Fed funds rate of 1.5, because that's the underlying inflation rate? Or does it imply a nominal Fed funds rate of 2 because the inflation rate is going to get back to 2 or maybe a touch above? And that's where I think the uncertainty for the dollar has crept in the last 3 or 4 months, is we don't know whether, you know, in effect that zero Fed funds rate, real Fed funds rate, implies a 1.5 or a 2 Fed funds rate.
I think going into that last meeting, we had a number of conversations about the Fed's ability to walk and chew gum at the same time, if they could focus on unwinding that balance sheet while they tried to raise rates. It sounds like from what you're saying, there is inherent difficulty in doing both things.
Well, I think that the market's looking for guidance on everything all at once, as it always is. And I think the Fed's taking this in steps. We've had, rate hikes in March and June. You know, our house view is that in September we'll get more clarity on beginning to wind down the balance sheet, let the balance sheet work its way down gradually. And that in December we'll probably get another rate hike. So I think we do have, in a sense, four action meetings this year, three of them rate hikes, one of them a balance sheet discussion.
You mentioned crude oil here. If I could ask you just about what we saw last week, of course, with the downturn in prices for oil. Where do you see WTI headed? Was that a blip, or do you think we're headed for lower prices here going forward?
You know, I've been expecting lower prices for much of this year. I think we actually may have bottomed out now. We were focusing on the low 42 range. I think we had a low back last November at 42.20. We just undercut it around 42.10 or so. That looks to me like a little bit of a double bottom, mm-hmm. and oil tends to like to double bottom, double top. So it wouldn't surprise me that we put in a bit of a double bottom here in the low 42s and that we maybe trade now, 42.52 over the next couple of months.
I mean, I'm intrigued by your real Fed funds rate, Bob. I guess I've looked at that chart before. I'm going to make it up here, folks. It is absolutely original, the duration of the negative real funds rate we've had before. I mean, it defines a lower bound. And yet within that, we're still within the great moderation. It's quiescent compared to what Mr. Volcker had to put up with in the double recession of the 80s. Is the great moderation still intact?
You know, I think it is. And, you know, as we know, we've talked about a number of times, I'm a big believer in the importance of demographics in dictating trends in the economy. And I think with the exception of Mr. Gura, the rest of us are getting into that age of savings and investment and trying to live off our savings. So I think the profile of the baby boomers is now very much of an investment profile. They're not borrowing, they're not leveraging, and as a result, I think it is a great moderation in the product markets. Where there is not a great moderation, I think, is in the asset markets, because that's where the baby boomers are involved. That's where they're putting their money. And so what we're seeing is, I think, a big focus not only on bonds, but now movement out into high-yield debt. And importantly, I think, into dividend-paying equities is another place for the baby boomers to invest. So in a sense, that great moderation in the product markets, in the housing markets, is showing up as a lack of moderation, in a sense, in asset markets.
It's I've never seen this chart. I'm going to feature this all month. Bob Sinch, you may have just come up with my chart of the year. It is amazing the period on a 10-year moving average from the middle 90s to the crisis, how they had a real funds rate of 2%. They actually managed the thing to where the textbooks want to be.
The textbooks would say that the real Fed funds rate should be at or slightly below growth potential, and that's where it was for decades. And what we've had now is just this, unprecedented and I think probably unhealthy period where the real Fed funds rate was negative by a significant amount, particularly if you take into account the impact of the expanding balance sheet. And again, so I think what we're looking at now is a Fed that, unless something goes wrong, they want to normalize. And again, the only uncertainty I see is whether normalizing that real Fed funds rate is 1.5 or 2.
Quickly here, we had Bill, I'll have you debate by proxy. Bill Lee was here and said the Fed shouldn't be worried about unwinding the balance sheet at all. Do you understand that argument? Does that argument make sense to you? Why do you think the Fed is wanting to tackle the balance sheet right now?
Because I think they believe that it's just unhealthy for a central bank to own that much of a government's
size,
debt. I mean, it's just not normal. It's not healthy. And in fact, when you think about, I'll go back to the demographics, you think about the baby boomers, there are a lot of us who wouldn't mind owning more government debt for the long term if it paid us a reasonable rate of return. So yeah. I think it would be healthy to shift it to the private sector.
Fat Finger Cinch with us from Amherst Pierpont. I mean, come on, Bob. You worked at a number of major houses, and when something happens and everybody knows a bonus just went out the window, everybody blames a proverbial fat finger. Come on. I don't buy it, ever.
Well, you know, you have to wonder, if you look at gold at gold prices, what usually would drive it. Lower would be a stronger dollar. We don't have that. Would be higher interest rates. We don't have that. So maybe it is somebody who's unwinding a
at the end of the half.
Unwinding a big position. Yeah, that's a distinct possibility. Mm.
But unwinding a big position is different than a fat finger. I mean, I think it's good that Bob Moon mentions that idea. Trading errors, you know, I think the mythology of the street is they happen all the time. And I think systems are actually pretty good, given the volumes.
I think systems are very good. They've gotten a lot better over the years. There's always a little flashing signal. You know, I can't even move too much money between my bank accounts without them asking whether I really want to send that much or not, or that little. So I do think that the probabilities of that, particularly in the London, New York time zones, are pretty limited.
How do you respond as a currency bond guy to where the equity markets are? 21,394 with futures up 7. I mean, can you link that into the Bob Cinch world?
You know, it strikes me as that line from, what was it, an officer and a gentleman, I got no place else to go. And I think that's really what's been driving what's going on in a lot of equities, particularly the dividend-paying sector of the equity markets, is that dividend yields of high-quality companies are very competitive with 10-year bond yields. So, and you have some upside potential and probably not as much, you know, perceived downside risk in pricing. So net, again, this is where I think the Fed wants to try to normalize conditions. And it's not normal for high-quality equities to still be paying higher dividends than 10-year treasuries.
We've valued your perspective on sterling here over the last year plus now. We're going to hear from Prime Minister Theresa May a little later this morning, carry that for you live at 9:30 Wall Street time. She's going to talk about the rights of EU citizens in the UK. What did we learn last week from her visit to Brussels, from that summit that she participated in, from the reception she got with her plan there to afford some citizens, afford some rights to EU citizens in the UK?
Well, I think what we've learned is that my guess is this goes into extra time, that they probably won't get all these issues solved within 2 years. I think we learned between last week and the Italian situation over the weekend is that the EU wants to stay as coalesced as they can. We had a potential issue with Italy versus the EU, and the European Commission just basically said, we'll take it away from the pan-European banking regulators, and you go ahead and deal with it yourself, because I don't think they want any conflict within within the EU. So I think what we see is that is sort of both sides staking out their positions. I still believe that as the second largest importer of EU products— that when we get to the final analysis and we get involved in trade deals, the EU has a lot to lose in not having an agreement with the UK. I mean, UK imports from the EU is second only to the US, and it's close, a close second. So I think this is going to be a long, long, drawn-out process. Again, I think it goes into overtime.
I lost money this weekend betting on the Yankees, the dreaded New York Yankees. Where's the appropriate trade right now, Bob Cinch? What's the trade to excite the second half of the year?
You know, I think that one of the most – you talk about the dollar movements. One of the most volatile currencies versus the dollar has been the Mexican peso.
Yeah, extended.
Worst performer in the second half of the year, best performer in the first half of the year. I think dollar max under 18, I would be long dollars. I think with the Fed continuing to move, with the Mexican economy slowing – and the Bank of Mexico finished in hiking rates, I think dollar Mexico's higher.
You heard it there, Bob Cinch. 17.93 on Mexican peso. Mr. Cinch suggesting stronger dollar, weaker peso, which would drive Mexican peso in the direction of 17 up to 18 handle, 19.20. I'm going to say it here for Bob Cinch. I mean, his target's 23. I'm kidding. Don't want to say that. That's not accurate. But anyways, seriously, there it is. On the swings of the Mexican peso, Bob Cinch looking for stronger dollar versus weaker Mexican peso. This is a real pleasure. He is the mayor of Boston. He's a different kind of mayor. Martin Joseph Walsh, Marty Walsh, taking over with awfully big shoes to fill in Tom Menino. He joins us from the mayor's conference in Florida. Mayor Walsh, what was it like taking over for Tom Menino? He was such a legend. What'd you do the first day when you had to fill the Menino shoes?
Well, the first day I had my first meeting was about public safety and crime in the neighborhoods. I promised that in the campaign office. And then later that day, Corporation Council came in and told me I had to make a decision on casinos, which I was not expecting. Mm-hmm. So I realized that this job is a little different than being a state representative. And for the next few months after that, it was fast. But, you know, following a 20-year mayor, I think a lot of people thought it'd be really, really hard. Not that Tom Menino was not a legend, but it was the fact that people were kind of interested in seeing. So many people grew up with just Tom Menino. They didn't know any other mayor. It's kind of almost like you get like a fresh start at it because so many people were wondering what it would be like. And it's been an incredible opportunity.
Mayor Walsh, here's the numbers you know. We welcome Bloomberg 1200 Boston and all of our radio listeners across the nation and worldwide to the topic you're focused on in Miami and the topic you're focused on 24/7. Here are the numbers, folks, over the last 5 years. 70, 87, 108, 150, and 196. Opioid deaths in Boston have essentially doubled over the last 24, maybe 30 months as well. Give us an update on how you and MGH and the other hospitals in the entire medical community in Boston are dealing with the opioid epidemic.
Well, Mass General Hospital has a couple programs over there. They're doing some incredible work. Boston Medical Center also is doing some incredible work with a program called the VIPER program. We're working in Boston. We created the first ever in the country Office of Recovery Services. We changed our main phone number. We added on our main phone number, I should say. Folks looking for treatment, they can call 311 in the city of Boston and get access to treatment. We're trying to make treatment easier for folks to access. But also, we have to do more around prevention. We have to talk to our kids younger. The epidemic that's going on in our country, I would say it's been going on for probably 20 years because it was crack before. It was heroin and now it's heroin and pills, prescription pills. And, you know, yesterday we had a meeting here at the U.S. Conference of Mayors where we had over 50 mayors in the room plus staff talking about addiction all across America in small, quiet, suburban towns, in rural areas, in urban areas. And my first meeting 3 years ago when I was appointed the chair of the task force here in U.S. Conference of Mayors, we had 12 mayors in the room. So you think about this issue and how it's magnified now across America. It's in every living room. Mm-hmm. It's in every kitchen. And families don't know what to do. And what we're trying to do now is provide the mayors and folks with a toolkit on how to deal with it. And Boston really has done some incredible things, as has like states like Minneapolis, Minnesota has done some incredible things as well. So, you know, we're trying to share best practices and trying, I don't know if you're going to get ahead of this, but too many young people are losing their lives. Yeah. Too many older people are losing their lives.
David Gura?
Yeah, you're dealing with it on a local level. You're seeing states deal with it at the state level. Is the federal government doing enough? We remember more than a year ago now, Governor Chris Christie in Belmont, New Hampshire, talking very movingly about his experience watching friends with opioid addictions. What does the federal government need to do in your estimation?
It has to do more. I mean, it has to really think about national policy and how we deal with this. And also we have to think about how do we help law enforcement and be able to get the drugs off the street and guns off the street, quite honestly, because sometimes they go hand in hand with the accessibility to it. But the federal government, they don't necessarily need to tell us how to react and how to do our job, but they have to help us with funding. The president in his budget did put some money in for addiction services, which I gave him credit for, but it's not enough and it doesn't go far enough. And I think that it's time now. This is a national crisis. And during the presidential election, you know, Hillary Clinton was the first to talk about it. Chris Christie was very open. Jeb Bush spoke about it. Donald Trump spoke about it. Bernie Sanders. They all spoke about the need to deal with this issue. And this is really what we should be focusing on, issues like drug addiction in our country. We should be focused on issues like infrastructure in our country and housing in our country instead of getting sidetracked all day long about repealing the Affordable Care Act or... But I mean, those are the issues that really Americans care about that will affect every American in America.
Mayor Walsh was at the Conference of Mayors down in Miami Florida. I wonder what's driving the conversation down there. It's an opportunity for you to talk to others in your position across this country. What's the big overarching theme of this year's conference down in Miami?
Well, I think there's a couple. One is that we're a bipartisan group of mayors, and I think that's been mentioned almost in every single conversation we've had. The leader this year, the president, is Mitch Cornish, the mayor out of Oklahoma City. He's a Republican. So it's about how do we move our agendas forward. That's kind of the big theme. But healthcare seems to be the big number one dominant. When I started the week, I thought it would be infrastructure, but now it's clearly healthcare. The impacts that the Senate bill would have on local hospitals all across America could be detrimental. Also, the impact of seniors. And in Boston, we have obviously some of the greatest hospital institutions in the world. We will feel an impact, but they've been there so long that I think they can absorb it over time. But you get some of these hospitals around America in small little towns, that is the economic engine. And if they lose, patients that have health insurance, they don't have the backup like we do in Boston. And even in Boston, it'll be difficult. We're talking I think there's millions and millions of dollars that are impacted here. So this Affordable Care Act is kind of taking over the dominance of the conference, asking the Senate to delay the vote on Thursday and to really work some positives into the bill. My fear, though, is that a lot of the senators that are holding out on Thursday are holding out because they don't think the bill goes far enough. That's a concern of mine.
Give me a city that you admire. I imagine you're talking to your counterparts leading other cities, and you're hearing about things they're doing differently, things that are innovative. As you come back from Miami to Boston, what's a big takeaway, something you've seen that you might like to implement in Boston?
That's a good one. I think, let me think of some stuff. I Eric Garcetti in L.A. is doing some great things around the environment. We are as well. A lot of the technology that we're having here, I think, I'm trying to think. There's a lot of different things going on here. I mean, I admire the cities like Louisville, New Orleans, obviously. Down here in Miami Beach, the Mayor Levine's doing some great things down here in Miami. You have, Providence, Rhode Island. Lorenzo is doing some innovative things in Providence. I think that we're all kind of sharing best practices on how we do things. There's some mayors in Minnesota that are doing some incredible things on opioids and drug addiction that we aren't doing in Boston and that we aren't doing in the country. So we look at different places to pick up different ideas. There's not one idea that's jumped out at me this week, but there's some great people down here. Nan Whaley in Dayton, Ohio, is doing some incredible things with the Tri-County mayors on addiction as well. She was talking about it yesterday. So there's some great mayors here doing some great things.
Tell me about what you need from Mr. Trump. It's been such a zoo, and we're following the zoo every day like anybody else. What does a mayor of a big city need from President Trump?
I think we need him to be the president. I think we need him to stop the rhetoric with the Twitter. And I think he needs to put some people around him that understand the process. I think that every time that he responds negatively to a tweet or to some outrageous statement, it affects all our cities indirectly. And I think that I would ask him, if I had a chance to sit with him, that, he still has an opportunity to have a good presidency and get the ship back on, or get the train back on the track, if you will. Because right now, you just can't keep just pulling these issues out of the air and going at them. Focus on infrastructure. I mean, he talked about that. Focus on infrastructure. Focus on the addiction. As I mentioned earlier, I think he put $500 million into a budget for addiction services. Focus on opioids and drug addiction in America. Focus on housing. The immigration thing. Take what he's done and all the rhetoric around the conversations about sanctuary cities and taking funding away and turn it around and say, okay, let's tell Congress to do a comprehensive immigration reform bill. I think those are the things that we need our president to get back to. I mean, we're not used to this type of leadership in the country. And I know a lot of people, not a lot, people still support the president that are listening to the radio. I want him to be successful. I think we all want him to be successful because we want the United States to be successful. But right now, we're not around the world. We're not viewed as the country we were 8 months ago, and that's a shame and sad statement for America.
Mayor Walsh, a couple weeks back, Tom and I came into the studio. We saw the news about Jeff Immelt leaving General Electric, and it caught us by surprise. I wonder the degree to which it caught you by surprise and what it means for that company's role in the city of Boston, the role he's played and what the company's going to be doing going forward.
Yeah, you know, I was a little surprised. I don't know the corporate world as much, and I was surprised to see that he was being moved out. He's been there for a while, but now when you see the new person coming in that has a healthcare background as well, you see him, it makes sense. They moved to Boston. You know, we have these great hospitals, teaching hospitals. We have all these medical schools in Boston and Massachusetts. So I guess you can see the kind of the thought process behind it. You know, GE's been an incredible neighbor. They've only been there for several months now, but they've already made, you know, over a $50 million investment in philanthropic support, whether it's schools or healthcare or job training. So I look forward to working with the new person. But Jeff was, you know, yeah. I'll be grateful to Jeff for making the move to Boston, Massachusetts.
Down from the Cask and Flagon, after you go over the Kenmore Bridge, instead of turning left onto Yawkey Way, you now turn right on David Ortiz Drive. Was that fun doing your own infrastructure last week?
Yeah, it was great. You know, it was bittersweet. I mean, it was great. And I said this about that, David. You know, he's getting a lot of accolades because his play on the field. And I mentioned that at the dedication. But also, you know, a day after the marathon bombing, when the city was in a desperate state as far as, you know, not sure what's going on, David Ortiz took the field at Fenway, and he made an incredible statement. And he's been such an important piece of our city off the field, whether it's through his own Children's Trust Fund or the things he's done. He's a Bostonian, born in the Dominican Republic, an immigrant. That is as much of a Bostonian as anybody, and it was a great honor. But it was sad too, because not seeing him on the field, like when you go to Fenway, you miss him in the fourth spot. You miss him being there for all these great moments. You know, I grew up in the era of not winning World Series and losing
really?
In '86. And for the young people that grew up seeing, you know, like it's normal for the Red Sox to win World Series. Big Poppy was as big, if not the biggest part of all of that.
And my problem, Mayor, is he's got some free time on his hands. You watch your back. He may be running.
Yeah, he looks good, though. I tell you, he looks like he can still play. I mean, he's in incredible shape. And he's just such a humble man. I mean, he's just a humble man. And, you know, when you see an athlete that has risen to the level that he has, to be so humble, it's great to see that at the end of their career, they're humble.
Mayor, thank you so much, particularly your comments from Miami on what you've been working on with the mayor's the opioid epidemic. Marty Walsh is the mayor of Boston. And again, we say good morning. Bloomberg 1200, Boston as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. bofaml.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.